You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
Welcome, you're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, and we are, as usual, have a lot of news for you this week. A lot of environment news, no guests, all news.
No guests, all news.
100% news this week. Well, the news is there's no guests.
Oh, okay. So now you're all caught up.
Stefan and Deirdre are here with me today, and we're going to be talking about a wide variety of news. And just before the show, Stefan had a good idea, which is that we're actually going to start with the worst news of the week. And get better. So unlike normal shows where it's just sort of like you can't really enjoy the good news because it's in a sandwich of bad news, right. The show will slowly improve. So if you're having a rough day, hang on. If you're having a really rough day, maybe tune out for like 10 minutes and then come back. Yeah, exactly. Or if you're listening to the podcast, maybe fast forward a few
minutes.
There we
go. Well, yeah. As we discovered, some people just skip the entire show and just listen to Deirdre.
Yeah, right to the bonus show.
Yeah, exactly. You just want to hear Deirdre.
Well, we have Deirdre will actually be on the main program today, and I have a topic for the bonus show. I'm not going to tease that right now. We'll get to that later.
All right.
Without further delay, however, Stefan, you're going to introduce our first news story.
Yes. So as the environment goes, as environmental news goes, we started in part because this is an unprecedented thing I think we've talked about. I feel like we're generally pretty good at covering some of the larger disasters or extinctions or things like that are occurring in the world, especially within the environmental field. But this, I think, I've never reported on this before. I didn't even know it was a thing that could possibly, I didn't even consider it. But in Bolivia, Lake Puopo was officially declared evaporated last month. And I didn't fully understand that you could. Often get officially declared, extinct, but officially declared evaporated was a new sentence that I did not fully understand.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this is that it's, of course, an example of some of the things that are happening. A German glaciologist who studies the rising temperatures from burning of fossil fuels, named Dirk Hoffman, called this, "This is the picture of the future of climate change." That's a direct quote.
Yeah, and I want to just jump in there really quickly, which is that one thing when we're reading a lot of like news stories, or especially like official documents about official goings-on, there's a lot of like technical definitions of things, right? Especially with science and whenever you're talking about either science or policy, aka 98% of this program, a lot of the time there's like an official declaration of something. So like in a lot of cases, I was expecting, because it would be normal, evaporated means that it has 80% loss. No, it's gone.
It's 100% gone.
Yeah, there's photos. It's gone.
Yeah, it just doesn't exist anymore. And you can read it. It's a whole bunch of different. And again, what I think was partially interesting about this whole thing is that it comes from a. It's not just one thing. Often when things like this, you want one thing to blame. And I think part of the difficulty of talking about climate change so often is that there's never just one thing. So part of this is the fact that the Andean glaciers are disappearing. And so a lot of the actual water that was going to go in was filling up this lake stopped or was slowing down. And then El Nino, the drought caused by the recurrent El Nino, basically in some ways, again, took away a lot of the extra water and it evaporated a lot of the water. And then combine these sort of things already with the fact that then there's a big diversion of water into local mining, and some diversion into agriculture, but the larger one went to mining. Cause this whole thing. So it's not just one. Part of this thing I think is interesting, again, which we try to cover on the show, is that climate change isn't going to just come in. It's not a boogeyman of one specific thing, right? And it's not like outside of El Nino, and theoretically outside of the Andean glacier meltings, maybe the amount of water that mining was taking would have been fine. You know, maybe that would not be a problem. Mm. But it's the sort of combination effect of all these different things that have led them to basically believe that they don't actually think it's coming back.
Yeah.
In this article from the New York Times, they interview a local named Juvenal Gutierrez, and he says he's moved because he said there's no future here.
Yeah, people are sold their boats; they're gone.
Yeah,
they're gone. So, I mean, I think that's a really important thing here, and we'll harp on that theme. Our token harping on this theme for this week was just the idea that a lot of the time when we're looking at just to continue to challenge that idea that somebody's got this, there's somebody on it. Right. Mm-hmm. Somebody in the government, it's someone's job to watch this, is that it's not frequently it's not. And sometimes it's outright ignorance. And sometimes that it's that lobbyists, and we'll get back to that topic in a minute, have, found a way to either use loopholes or manipulate policies to their advantage. And so one of these things will be in tons of cases, and like we're seeing with all these pipeline discussions here in Canada, yes, we're doing some consultations, but only these six people get to say anything, and they only get to talk for 3 minutes. But it's the same sort of thing, like we're in this thing where exactly where they're like, okay, well, we're measuring the amount of water this water body normally has, and we're measuring the amount of water that the mine gets to take, and B minus A equals C. Good. Well, good. Yeah, but you didn't take anything else into account. Nothing else was considered. And so it means that even if that has the best science ever applied to it, it's rendered completely invalid because you just didn't take the bunch of stuff into account. And that's basically the story of humans so far as attempt to deal with climate change was, hey, but we did this. Yeah, but you didn't count. It's not the right answer. The numbers you're using are basically made up. And this is a perfectly example of that. I bet there's a bunch of people there that were shocked. It was like, but we were monitoring. Well, you screwed up.
Well, not to mention just the idea of that monitoring is enough. It's the same thing. Yeah. I to sort of throw back to last week's hard point, which was just the idea that consultation with First Nations is not listening to them. they can consult the scientists to find out how much water we're running out of, but if the consultation doesn't lead to policy, then nothing changes.
Yeah.
So the last piece about this that I find interesting important to note is that it's now that it's down to 2% of its former water level. So really, when we say it's gone, it's gone. And basically, it used to be 16 feet deep. So it's never a super, super deep lake, but it was an important lake. And biologists say that 75 species of birds have now left the lake. But perhaps more importantly, from a human level, this is an example of it's really hard to explain to people where all these sort of quote unquote climate refugees might come from. Mm-hmm. When there's these numbers of how many climate refugees people expect to exist from time to time, everyone is always like questioning the numbers. They seem too high or whatever. But these are the kind of things where you won't even necessarily, people won't even be counted as refugees because they're moving from inside Bolivia to another part of inside Bolivia.
Right.
But it's still displaced people.
And where are they going? They're going to already crowded and underfunded cities.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And what they what they was once sustaining them now can't.
Right.
And this isn't even being counted because no one fully knows how many people were in this town in the first place. It sounds as if at one point there were a couple, like 3,000 to 4,000. Mm. But this lake was obviously a major part of their livelihoods. So none of these people are sort of the forgotten people affected by climate change because they just end up in cities and everyone just is like takes that, then they becomes parts of urban, and a whole story about how, urban cities are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But you want to know why? It's because we're destroying the land that people are living off of in other places. Mm. If you can't get water because your lake evaporated, then you're going to move somewhere else. I think it's important to remember these sort of stories when people start talking about sort of displaced people or climate change causing refugees, because it's not necessarily going to be super obvious how or where they came from.
Yeah, and I think the last thing on that point is exactly, just to finish your thought there, was that, yeah, then they're going to move, and then they're going to be consuming less – more people will be consuming less resources where they move to. And that's one of those – that's yet another thing that's almost never calculated in any of this stuff. Be like, oh, well, those people move. Well, yeah, but they didn't vaporize.
Yeah.
They went somewhere, and they're still going to need resources. They're still going to need clean water, and they're going to need food, and they're going to need shelter, and that's going to come from somewhere else that now has less of a resource from that. So you're decreasing supply and increasing demand. is a very shaky road to go on when you're always moving in that direction. And pretty much everything is every single thing. We're talking about food, arable land, places you could live, anything we need for anything. All of those things. There's more need and less availability. But yeah, everything's fine, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last thing part of that is whenever you displace someone from where they are, you're moving them from a place where their skills were built up to live in that area to another area. You know, people who are used to living in a rural fishing village cannot just move. They aren't going to learn how to code and start working at a, you know, like at.
It's so funny. I was going to say the exact same example.
Yeah, like it's just, you know, that's not, maybe they will, but that's not a solution for everyone.
Right.
But anyways, to move on. To get to the next topic, because this sort of carries on our you know, little bumpy road here, bumpy road of a week, is the climate scientists under attack from frivolous lawsuits article out of the Guardian,
right?
In part, so it's a jump from sort of thing, but I think this is important because we started off with how places go when we don't listen to science necessarily, and now we're talking about why scientists are harder to getting heard, basically.
Right.
And it will lead into our sort of our minor tease by you already lobbyist thing from earlier.
Right. So the thing about this one as well was that, this is something we already knew was going on, but we have to sort of remind people, and it has to be taken within context. So, I mean, there's one thing, which is that there's something called the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund. They're defending climate scientists against frivolous lawsuits. And they're like, great, okay, so they have defense. Well, it's not that simple because there's very limited supply of extremely smart and well-educated and funded and validated and proper degrees and whatever people. And there's a very concerted effort to with people with a whole bunch of money to spend and money to lose around climate change, who are basically just doing a cost-benefit analysis and going, I can spend $100,000 and waste a bunch of scientists' time, take 6 months out of the research time, completely shut down all of their stuff. A lot of the time, these grants will disappear. It's not like they can't delay their work. They're all on timelines. And you can set back some research that might have, cost you hundreds of millions of dollars, but all you got to do is throw $100,000 at it. That's nickels. That's nickels on the dollar for these people, but you're literally crushing it. So there's numerous examples of this. But the thing that I want to put into context, just before I throw back to you, Stefan, is that, this is being done at the same time that Exxon is literally being investigated for deceiving the public. We have a story we did a few weeks ago about Peabody Energy, the failed coal company that's now bankrupt, partially because instead of investing in modifying their business to deal with reality, they invested insane sums, even for them, insane sums of money in trying to fight reality. It's a losing strategy in every possible direction. We already have people being investigated essentially for fraud, and yet there doesn't appear to be any way or any incentive, if there is a way, to prevent this from keeping happening. Like, we know it's happening. We've established that it is a fact that it's happening, and it's simply continuing. And that's the thing that I find mind-boggling. At what point do you go, okay, we need to make a small policy change here. We need to change a law to make it so that some form of anti-slap legislation where they'd be like, oh, great, you're going to file a frivolous lawsuit. That's $10 billion.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned Peabody Energy because this story itself actually centers around an organization called Energy and Environment Legal Institute. And I love all of the names of organizations that are against climate change. They're
Friends
always
of Science.
Funny.
Yeah.
They're
Friends
always
of Science
funny.
Is my favorite. It's
yeah.
my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this organization, Energy and Environment Legal Institute, who is carrying out these frivolous lawsuits, are funded by one and only Peabody Coal, as well as Arch Coal, Alpha Neutral Resources, and other. And so these are billion-dollar companies funding this organization that literally is just going around suing climate scientists. And what's interesting is the way they're doing it. This is in their own words. Their goal the way they do is they sue it for emails because they want all email correspondence.
Right.
And the fight here is that is that basically they're saying like, well, it's open science. That's what we should be doing. But the scientists are like, well, we can't have candid conversations on our emails if we know we're going to get sued over them, right? And but even so, the people, so the organizations themselves who are doing this, the suing, have in their own words saying their goal is to embarrass both Professor Hughes in this particular case and Overpeck and the university. So they're suing for the stated goal of embarrassing these climate scientists and the university, not because so like which undermines their entire credibility from the get go.
Some people's response to this is the idea that, you know, that that whole thing about with the people's response to a lot of like police state stuff, which is, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to fear? Okay, well, as you've already identified, this is you're actively using this to prevent, to harass them and to prevent them from doing their research, is part of it. But it's also the case that, like, can anyone with a straight face right now, honestly, everybody who's listening to my voice right now, think about it. If someone went through every email you'd ever sent and had the ability to pull sentences out at random that you could not be made to look bad, can anyone say that with a straight face? Stefan, if people went through our correspondence, do you think they could find anything that taken out of context would seem embarrassing?
I think if someone listened to the show long enough, out of context, they could do that.
Yeah,
they don't even need the email.
The only saving grace is that we have something like 10,000 hours on the record that could be used for context. But absolutely, like, this is ludicrous.
Yeah.
The fact again that they can't simply be sued out of existence for wasting everybody's time and being counter to science for something that's obviously nonsense.
Yeah,
it boggles my mind.
So the reason why it's back in the news actually is a mildly depressing reason, which is because previously the Virginia Supreme Court actually denied their claims and ruled that academic research correspondence actually should be protected. But then much more recently, the court reversed its earlier decision and determined and said that actually disclosure was warranted. And their quote at that point was that alternative methods of communications have been made and remain available to Professor Hughes and Overpeck and any other similarly situated persons should they desire to correspond in confidence regarding research projects and like endeavors. Which is in the article is pointed out that that's basically telling climate scientists that if they ever want to talk about their research in a candid way, they have to call people. Because if you don't call people, then we can always get all of your emails.
And the thing that wasn't in the article that I find ludicrous is you think they're not just going to sue for your phone records after? Like, it's just it's nonsense. It's
yeah.
So silly.
But what I actually want to get to is a larger context here. To pull back a little bit, is this conversation about this way of using sort of SLAPP legislation and the way it's entering not only science but also the media. Because you know, anti-SLAPP legislation has existed,
strategic lawsuits against public participation, which doesn't perfectly apply here, but it's close enough.
No, exactly, but it's existed in public participation for a long time, right? It existed that in the public sphere, companies would sue people basically to scare them away. Mm. And what's kind of terrifying about this is that's taking that tactic and bringing it to science in the media. Mm. And then as you do that, the numbers and the problems get magnified. And so what's interesting about this is that when I read this article, it reminded me of Peter Thiel's attack on Gawker, which, for those who don't know, Peter Thiel is a billionaire on the board of Facebook who really, really doesn't like Gawker Media for legitimate reasons. But again, after that, basically gets lost. Yeah. And he...
It's a case study on how much of a temper tantrum you can throw if you're a billionaire.
And what you can do, yeah. Right? So basically what Peter Thiel did was that he went around and funded every single person who wanted to sue Gawker. Everyone. And so what that meant, there's a whole bunch of sort of minor cases that he was helping with, and the biggest one was also Hulk Hogan. And they won the Hulk Hogan case, which then meant Gawker already had to pay out a whole bunch of money. But then on a smaller scale, the fact that he was going to have killed them, his whole plan was, and Gawker has now declared bankruptcy, because he's basically, and he was never going to stop. He had billions of dollars. It was super cheap on the dime for him to use this method to try to destroy a media outlet.
For a personal grudge, no less, valid or not.
Yeah.
I actually have sympathy for the grudge. I have no sympathy for the response to it.
Exactly.
But it was a legitimate grudge, but it was a personal issue.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, and this as a way to silence media. If tech billionaires start discovering that they can just get anything, any story they don't like, they can just threaten to sue you into non-existence, that has an unbelievable quieting effect. on this sort of stuff. And that's what terrifies me about this sort of it coming into the world of science and media, is that we will need some sort of legislation to start actually, you know, addressing the fact that right now we're in a scenario where the incredibly rich can basically use our internal systems and perfectly legally to fight things. Deirdre.
Do you guys think that it would be the same case in Canada? Do you think, like, if Gawker was a Canadian company and was being sued by a Canadian, do you think the judicial system would be... Because I know, like, the judicial system here is different than the States. Like, we don't have as many suing cases. That stuff just doesn't happen as much. It's not as easy. Do you think it'd be the same? Do you think Gawker would still be big?
I think it's a very Canadian, a very American style thing, and that has a lot to do with the laws. Admittedly, not an expert on either the Canadian or the American laws, but my belief is that would not be the case. But
it would be much harder.
Yeah, it would be very, very
there
hard.
There are definitely a bunch of rules that make suing a lot easier in the United States and not here. In part, I believe if you sue and you lose here, you always have to pay the other person.
Right,
person's legal fees. So it would be a lot harder to actually. Mm-hmm. But again, I honestly think if you have enough money, and because like again, even if you never are going to lose, even if you will eventually lose, if you can sap enough money out of an organization beforehand, and part of this also is just responding to the legal challenges. That's difficult. So I think it definitely is less likely in Canada because of our laws make it more difficult. But I still think that if you really wanted to, you could probably. You'd probably pull it off at least to some degree.
If there's any lawyers out there who are screaming at the radios right now who wish to correct us, greenmajority.ca is a great way to contact us. There's more on this lobbying. We're gonna actually move into a Canadian example now, but I want to go to the break first here. We'll come back. We'll start fresh. We're going to talk more as both Seven and I have teased. We're going to talk a little bit about lobbying and how you can evade the rules in Canada. And so another way, so we've got, you know, public suits and public harassment and threatening. We also have behind-the-scenes stuff that apparently is completely legal to do, you know, because loopholes. Well, you didn't technically. Steph and I, you know, don't eat my cookies. Well, it's not technically a cookie. It's technically a small pie. Oh, darn it.
It's a small chocolate chip pie. Delicious, delicious chocolate chip pie.
You win again. You're listening to The Green Majority, whether it sounds like it in the last 10 seconds or not. You are, in fact, listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM on one of our wonderful and extremely appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country and now internationally as well, in addition to our partners over at rabble.ca for promoting our podcast on their site as well. Very appreciated to all of them and all of you for listening to the program. We're going to be back with more news in just a minute after we hear from Alex, who is our tech this week, who's going to tell us what we're going to listen to. All right, you are listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you enjoyed the brief glimpse of that track, you will be able to find more information about Alex's band on the website, as usual, at greenmajority.ca, along with links to every single one of these stories. Because we publish our notes.
Yes.
Transparency? No. We just spend a lot of time in university, and it's kind of a habit now. So show your work, friends. All our work is shown on the website, greenmajority.ca. It's also where, if you're listening on the radio, you can find the podcast version, of which you will hear a slightly extended version of the show. We have a little bit of a looser discussion at the end, a little bit more freeform. Occasionally, there's some colorful language as both either a promotion or a warning, depending on your particular tastes. And it also occasionally, I would say potentially frequently, gets off topic. So we're not even necessarily talking about the environment stuff. I have a feeling I made it want to talk about something completely nothing to do with the environment this week. But well, it's a secret. You have to listen to the show to
there
find out. Yeah, but there's a thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Getting back to the news, though, Stefan, we're talking about lobbying. Do you want to lead us in here?
For sure. So this is to carry on our mining theme. I think the theme might be mining to some extent as well. Which is that there's been a sharp uptick reported for one of the fascinating little pieces of community news to some extent. You know, community seems to make it sort of minor, but there's a lot of
industry news.
No, I was going to say outside of industry news. You know, sort of it's one of these pieces of news that sort of comes from Despog Canada, which again is one of these sites that. It's not a mainstream news site. It's alternative news. That's what I was looking for. It's alternative news. One of our friends in alternative news.
I should add, just because for some people that's not a positive alternative, but al- also extremely well referenced.
Oh yes, for
so
sure.
So this is the DSmog blog. It's not like Steve's opinions.
Although stevesopinions.com, great website.
If that's not patented, I'm going to go home and do it right now. We have to find a Steve.
Carry on. My dad's name is Steve. We can ask him. But this is a story from DSmog blog, and it's all about the mining industry, and they're apparently on a bit of a lobbying spree. In so much so that they actually have since Trudeau got elected, since the new election, there have been 164 quote unquote registered communications with a couple of the larger mining companies. And to put that in perspective, that's actually more than the three largest oil and gas lobbying groups combined. Mm. And during this one period of time. But it's interesting to sort of see this uptick at that moment. So the article is really asking sort of like, well, why? You know, why suddenly now are mining companies sort of flocking to the federal government to plead their case? And there's a couple things. I think the one part, of course, is that there's that the Trudeau government is making noises, which I think is the highest praise I can offer the Trudeau government. They are making noises about doing things, such as respecting Aboriginal lands, and then also it actually in this DSmog blog it gives them credit for Trudeau saying he's considering a federal wide carbon tax. I have no faith that's going to happen.
Yeah, just as a really quick note on that, that was actually something I pulled out of here as well, which is like, I was like, wow, the mining industry has a higher opinion of Justin Trudeau than we do, apparently.
Yeah, the mining industry.
Because they're apparently, since he's been elected, terrified that he might start to regulate them, and apparently all the people in the environment movement, or at least most of them, have been like, he's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
I just find that amusing, that they're more concerned about his liberal agenda than we are.
Well, I think you see that almost everywhere. Although, to be fair, you know, there was... I think there's a flip side of this is that them being scared is at least somewhat interesting to me. In that same way that when the coal companies started coming to the Ontario government being like, regulate us, that was because they saw the writing on the wall. Mm. But to carry on, there's a couple different things about going on in the mining industry right now. That's sort of the flag. So it's the one, they're scared of the ways the federal government can come into it. But two, they're also obviously the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is still in the process of being decided on whether we sign it or not, which obviously they have large interest in. And then prices are down everywhere. And this is the part that I find actually kind of fascinating, is that we see this fact that iron ore prices and copper and gold are all down. Gold did jump up after Brexit, but I'm not sure exactly where they are, how long that is going on. But commodity prices are down, and I think that's interesting. That same time that oil has gone down, it's almost like the markets are telling us that these things are becoming less valuable, and maybe we should stop investing in them. I don't know the market. I'm not sure I'm reading the market correctly, but Deirdre,
I don't know if you guys saw the recent hype on Twitter about The Economist posting about why millennials aren't buying diamonds.
Oh, I did see that, and I laughed.
But I think we're along the same lines.
Yeah, gold always jumps whenever there's something doomy seeming, and because when the world's gone to hell and society's broken down and we're all living in like a Mad Max universe, if there's one thing you know you need, it's gold.
It's gold.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. The diamonds one is great. All of the responses to that were so hung.
Yeah.
It's like because they're useless. Is that the reason why?
I don't know about them. I'm investing in astronaut ice cream and shotgun shells personally.
So the diamond
diamond versions.
There we go. Yeah, can we get ice cream and diamond?
Gold.
Is that a thing? Is that an option?
Yeah.
But what I find so fascinating about all this is that it is, you know, all of this sort of fear is being built up around these commodity prices going down, and all at the same time. And so there's this massive lobbying effort now to find a way to save them, quote unquote. When in part it's like maybe we just do other things. And as a quick aside on these other things, and we'll come back to the whole lobbying effort, but this segues too well. Is that there's another report coming out actually also on DSmog about how geothermal energy could put thousands of Alberta's oil sector back to work in the oil and gas sector by repurposing oil wells into geothermal. And some of this is like, this is a conversation, and what's fascinating about this, of course, is that the currently government regulations actually don't let that happen because they haven't figured out how to deal with it.
Yeah. This is something we've talked about before, but not in this specific way, which is that due to our Canadians, specifically Albertans, to a large degree, but Canadians' expertise in some very difficult style of drilling and mining and other sorts of resource extraction, we actually know a thing or two about drilling, and yeah. It turns out that's the most important thing for geothermal. And it turns out Alberta's got a whole ton of it, but where are these people going to apply their expertise, Stefan?
Well, exactly. Well, that's the thing. And the question is whether or not the Alberta government can actually get on board and actually start providing the abilities to them to actually get back to work in this manner. And it's a fascinating sort of transition that could be happening, and yet we're still talking here about, you know, you wonder why they're lobbying so much. The lobbying is because they don't want us to change the conversation. Mining and oil and gas have very, very high interests in not having conversations about geothermal. And to a memo to anyone who's currently running an oil and gas business in Alberta and wondering how to get environmentalists on side, a good first step, start using your wells for geothermal. That at least start walking the walk a little bit if you want to prove you actually care about this sort of thing.
I don't have time to pull up the number right now, but we know it starts with a B. Billion. The amount of money spent trying to, and we'll get to this in a second, develop clean energy from dirty energy. Mm-hmm. So things like clean coal and clean tar sands and all this sort of thing. Billions of dollars spent.
Well,
instead of spending a couple hundred grand or a couple million dollars with the well you've got, this is the thing where I think this is a perfect example, I think, of why so many people who, you know, are not super face pressed against the glass on this stuff get so confused, I think, about why, you know, or just sort of assume out of knee jerk reaction that so many of the environmentalist claims are ignorant. First of all, because the people in these sectors go, oh, come on now, children, you don't know what you're talking about. This is big adult stuff, and basically are just super condescending about the whole thing. And then everyone else goes, well, that has to be true, because you wouldn't, if what the environmentalist was claiming, like, who wouldn't do that? It's so obvious, so they have to be wrong. No, it's actually that bad. That's why we're so upset.
Yeah, well, and so an example of this, to carry on our coal conversation, is the attempts to bring up to bring clean coal into the United States. And it's a fundamental piece of their platform. And this is an article, multiple articles actually come out through Vox and in New York Times. It's a pretty big news story right now, which is that in Mississippi, the sort of one of the centerpieces of this idea of clean coal, which was a part of Obama's regulations of coal plants, was be like, okay, well, if you're going to do that, you have to reduce the amount of, like, if you want to have coal still, it needs to find ways to reduce its carbon. And so this idea of clean coal got a lot of play, but then, you know, when Darren says the word billions, that's not a lie. Even this one Mississippi coal plant, the Kemper coal plant in Mississippi, is already 2 years behind schedule and more than $4 billion over its original budget, which. And it's like $4 billion. Like, I feel like whenever you say over budget things, the important is to know actually how much the original budget was.
Right.
Because, you know, if it's a $3 trillion project and you're $4 billion over, that's within the margin of error. And this is a $4 billion over its initial budget, which was $2.4 billion. So this is almost double what they said it was going to cost.
They should have
in
said
the
nearly 300% over budget.
Yes,
or, like, yeah, I, like yeah
exactly. Like a much wider range, and it's still not operational.
So two really quick quotes from this article. We're going from a New York Times article on this, as Stefan alluded to. There's numerous reports on this. Just really quickly, two things that I had to pull out that I thought was hilarious. So part of the reason that this is even a story was because they had an internal whistleblower. And this whistleblower is not somebody who's against this stuff. They're a huge defense. They really believe in this technology. So this isn't some hippie liberal that, you know, broke in and did some whatever. This isn't somebody. This is somebody inside the company who is just like, okay, I can't keep my mouth shut anymore. Two hilarious quotes. This is great. So his name is Mr. Wingo. Quote, I've reached a personal tipping point and feel a duty to act. He's talking about in his 2014 email, which was among a whole bunch that he sent, trying to get people's attention, saying, you know, what's going on here? Another quote from him was, hope is not a strategy. This is a high-profile project with many misguided enemies, so why give them free ammo? And I think that's really illustrative to talk about sort of his point of view, right? Like, this is a true believer. Yeah. This is somebody who's completely, and to this day, despite this story, still believes that this is a valid technology and the right way to go. So just for context, to add to that, one other quote that I wanted to pull from him, which was now from the former executive for Mississippi Power. One of the project's biggest mistakes was to start construction with little of the plant designed. Quote, "We believe that from an investor standpoint, this is a wise investment to prove the technology." Mm-hmm. $3 billion later, 300% over budget. They didn't actually have a plan about how it was going to happen before they started construction.
Yeah.
But don't worry. These guys, they totally know. This, you know, forget those stupid hippie liberals and their damn environmentalists and their damn scientists. These guys are sure that if you keep throwing money down that hole, Stefan, one day.
If I can harken back to what's funny about that exact sentence you just made is that really early on in this year, I went to a large sustainability conference in Vancouver. I mentioned earlier on the show, and at one point in time, there was a oil and gas executive giving some sort of talk. And at one point, part of her position was whether or not was how on earth we could expect that to basically saying that we needed oil. And that her argument was that basically that solar and wind aren't ready yet. So instead, she wanted us to picture a world where every car had a carbon capture storage on its tailpipe. So we were still using oil, but every single car was individually capturing carbon capture, while simultaneously saying that wind and solar were not, quote unquote, not ready yet. And to me, it's like, this is the question. If we build a car right now, and one car gets to be powered on wind and solar, and one car gets to be powered on a clean version of oil and gas, and they're going to race in a year, which car even gets moving?
There's a chance that the second car in that list will not even have tires on it. and meanwhile, it's like fractally wrong, which is one of my favorite expressions I haven't had an opportunity to use in a while. It means wrong at every conceivable scale. So when they're talking about, well, wind and solar isn't ready, that's because the last time they heard anything about the current state of the technology was the late 80s. Mm-hmm. It is so ready, they have no idea what they're talking about. Second of all, hey, that thing that's not maybe like 80% as efficient as we'd like it to be, let's not do that. Let's invent this future possible thing that maybe one day maybe could be a reality, hopefully maybe if we get lucky and cross our fingers. But please give us all of your money and don't give them any money.
Well, and
that's what's happening.
Well, exactly. And you see the same exact thing when the tech billionaires get into this kind of conversation. You know, it's the reason why Bill Gates, despite doing so many good things, instead of saying we need to implement wind and solar on a national scale, says we need an energy miracle. It's like, no, that's not a solution. A solution, you know, to paraphrase the gentleman in the article you just referenced,
hope is not a strategy. Oh, that's going to – if I had a car, that would be in my bumper sticker. So we did say that the news was going to get better throughout. So
yes.
Why don't we – we're going to take another break here. And just to sort of – just to have somewhat of an incline on this section, Stefan, I would like to say –
with hope is not a strategy.
Strategy is pretty good. But just to say, as far as like the slowly increasing optimism of the program,
yeah,
is that one of the things I would like to point out is just that – I mean, if you've been a longtime listener of the show and of course, you know, for me having done the show for nearly 10 years at this point, the frequency with which these types of stories are being published in actual mainstream media and actually getting legitimate attention from the large mass of the public and from regulators and people is increasing, and the perceived credibility of the sources talking about these stories, underline on perceived credibility of the sources talking about these stories, is also increasing over time. So this isn't a win, but it's highly embarrassing for the people that I personally consider enemies, because they're killing the planet for their personal greed and putting their fingers in their ears. So
right.
Ideologically, they are my enemies.
Hmm.
So we're going to go to the war. So they're losing. That's
right.
The thing. They suck and we're winning. Are we going to win fast enough? Well, we're going to find out after the break. You're listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to come back and hear a whole bunch more from Deirdre, who's been one of our more science-educated people on the program, who's going to tell us a little bit about some science-y stuff, which I'm super interested to hear. I've read the articles, but I really want to hear what Deirdre actually has to say about them. So I'll be thrilled to hear this next section as well. We're going to go to a brief music break. We'll come back. Of course, you're listening on CIUT 89.5 FM. You can check out more information about the show and get additional content. Listen to the podcast as well at greenmajority.ca. Also, thank you to all of our syndication partners, including our radio partners, CIUT and Rabble.ca. But Alex now is going to tell us what our second and final music break is. Take it away. Nice fade. Alex with the fade. Well played. And that sounded a little insect-y, actually. So I'm wondering, I don't know if we're ready to go straight to that, but that will be a segue for at least part of this section.
Yes, exactly.
Stefan, you're going to jump us off here a little bit.
No, it's all Deirdre.
Oh, it's all Deirdre. All right, Deirdre, take it away.
Insects. I think I'm one of the few people in the world who actually cares about them. But we're going to talk about them a little bit today. So a bunch of scientists around the world, a bunch of organizations, different research groups have all come to this conclusion that insects are rapidly, rapidly declining. We've seen about a 40%-ish decline in every single family of insects worldwide over the past like four decades or so. And this has come from independent studies from various scientists, like meta-analyses, field studies. Everything is pointing to a huge decline in insect populations. But no one really cares. Like, I'm sure if I said that, like I just did, everyone would be just like, oh, okay.
Hooray, less bugs.
Yeah, like less mosquitoes, less spiders, I don't know, less everything, like less things climbing on us in summer, right? But I don't think people really understand what this means for the world. There's a really good quote from the head of BirdLife International in Germany. His name is Leif Miller. He said, there are many indications that what we see is the result of a widespread poisoning of our landscape. And that is, I mean, what do you guys think of that? It's kind of depressing, isn't it?
For some weird reason, a song by an artist I actually despise, but people keep singing it enough that it's stuck in my head, was that whole thing about I started at the bottom, now I'm at the top, or whatever.
Started from the bottom.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah. We're setting a fire to the bottom of that. So it will make it very hard to get to the top.
Yeah.
I don't know why that was in my head. It was.
Yeah. Insect. I love the idea of insects rising to the right of a human being.
I think a lot of people will do that. But the reason why, I mean, it's not a positive story, but the thing that I think is important to sort of discuss here was that, people's knee-jerk reaction, I think, Deirdre, you're right. I think most people's knee-jerk reaction is so what at best and good at worst. Mm-hmm. But that's really obviously not true. And I think you're wrong that you're the only person that doesn't care. And I think there are enough scientists out there that will, this is basically just increasing the number of people ringing alarm bells to try and put some sort of a positive spin on this. And to the extent that it's like, we're going to see really noticeable impacts. The trick with insects, though, and another way to sort of look at this was, I think there will be devastating impacts. There's going to be huge impacts on crop production, and of course they provide the food source for many higher order animals and whatever, many of whom we eat. So this will affect us directly in a ton of ways. However, insects are also extremely resilient because their birth cycle rates tend to adapt faster. And so I think that we'll probably get a good scare out of this, but the chance of us being actually able to wipe out all insect life, I think we'll be long gone before we successfully wipe out all insects. So, which is not to say don't be concerned, but it is to say, there's potentially here an area where we're going to see some impacts that will finally maybe be one of the ways that we get people's attention, because all of a sudden there's no food to grow. We're going to have a huge scare for a couple of years, and then maybe this could be something that where we could, it'll get people's attention. There'll be enough of an urgent reaction to drive people into some action. And it's an area where, unlike some things we could talk about with climate change, the pass no return thing is a lot farther just because of the resiliency of that type of life form.
But I think it's interesting also to point out that even within this sort of study of declining insects, there's a hierarchy of even insects. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about the organizations that we're losing, people are talking about even this art. So there's a very one quote from Martin Sorg, who's an entomologist, part of this study. His line is, the decline is dramatic and depressing, and it affects all kind of insects, including butterflies, wild bees, and hoverflies. What's fascinating about that is, even in the insect realm, everyone's like, but the butterflies and the bees, they're the insects that really matter. Let's talk about the, and, you know, it's I almost feel like we're doing the same sort of thing that we just did as a larger context, but the insects we don't like are invisible, in the same way that insects are invisible as a much larger context. But then bees and butterflies, which are both very important, especially bees, are the ones that still are the headline grabbers. I have no idea what hoverflies on it. That probably makes me a bad environmentalist. But it's interesting.
And every day, we're in the middle of this huge extinction. And every day, like, tons and tons of species are going extinct. And I think the majority of those are insect species. And that's kind of why, I mean, that just drives the point home that, like, we don't care as much about these species that we don't know about. I mean, insects, there are so many of them. And that's kind of one of the problems that these researchers are having, is that there are so many species, probably tons of species that we don't know about, and you can't study them all. Actually, one research group in Germany, I think might be the Zoological Society, they have come up with kind of an automated survey of biological diversity and richness. So hopefully that'll improve things. But as it stands, there's no way that we can get a good idea of what species are doing what where, because there's just not enough people doing these studies, and the data is really limited. What happens in climate change is that, like, a lot of these species are actually moving north, and in continents like Europe, where the countries are small, you might lose the species in Europe, but that might mean that a bunch of populations are going north, or they could be dying off. Like, a bad one bad winter could kill off whole species in a country, and they are resilient. But with the increasing erratic nature of climate change, it's harder for them to adapt, because these generations can't, I guess, like, drift that quickly. Like, genetic mutation doesn't happen that fast.
All I'm trying to say usually is that there's a really good chance that if we lose it, that the torch will likely be passed to one of these insects as the dominant life form on this planet. So we should probably start making
cockroaches.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly. I bet it's cockroaches. Say. Exactly. we promised the audience some later news, and Deirdre, you have a slightly happier second news story.
Well, happier. I would like to qualify happy because it will make a lot of our listeners happy, because it will validate something that they feel. That's my takeaway. I think this will. I think the news itself is neutral, but as far as it will confirm a lot of beliefs that people have.
So we're saying the closest we can provide to happiness is confirmation bias?
Neutrality and confirmation bias. It's like the audio version of Facebook.
Good. I do actually have some good news, and it's good news for a lot of reasons. So as we all know, gene technology is getting really big these days, in plants, in crops, in agriculture. But a scientist at the university, at Pennsylvania State University in University Park, Jonathan Lynch, has been kind of taking a different approach than tech companies to creating better agricultural plants. He's been looking at root structures and different genetic characteristics and hereditary traits of different plants around the world. And he and his team have been breeding using really traditional methods. And in some ways, they're actually beating out the GMO companies, partially because of the strict guidelines and testing that GMO companies have to face before putting anything out to the market. These guys, because they're not using technology, they're using traditional methods. It's just farming. So they can put these products out really fast. And that's becoming more and more important every day, because in countries that are suffering from drought and agricultural losses, especially countries in Africa, are really suffering, and they need a solution right now to be able to provide food for a lot of people in a short amount of time, and make sure that that's consistent. And I spent a bit of time in Tanzania, where it's mandatory to plant fields. And this happens in areas where farming is not the most efficient use of land, and the soil is not good for farming. So it results in a lot of crop failure every year. Lynch's work actually might help this, because part of his work is looking at drought resistance and also nitrogen and phosphorus efficiency, so nutrient efficiency in the roots. He's actually been incredibly successful, and if he can get those to countries in Africa, he's already gotten them to countries in to China and rural areas in China, and it's already helping people out there. So if he can get those out to the rest of the world, then I think we might be in good shape.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think the underlying point there, a couple things just to highlight, you already said, but I want to highlight them, Deirdre, here, is that as well, there's a few important takeaways from the story. One of them is that, you know, they're beating some of these GMO high-tech options in a non-apples and apples situation. Like they've been working on the GMO stuff for a decade. It's still not ready. And they started like a couple years ago. Yeah. And they're already like being planted somewhere. So there's one. So, you know, the natural approach is winning. Part of that is due to the regulation, which I think is super important. But that's the other part of the story. Because there's such a rush to get this stuff, because people need it now, there's a lot of pressure being very tactfully applied by these companies, Monsanto, to rush through and to reduce the regulations around things like GMO, genetic engineering, and messing with biology. Because they're like, hey, we need a solution now. We have to find a way to fast track this, which is just a nightmare scenario. And so we agree that we're probably going to talk a little bit more about the whole GMO situation. I have a few comments about that as well. We're going to leave the sort of generalized GMO conversation for the bonus show, I think, at least briefly. But as far as this story is concerned, was there something else that jumped out at you, Stefan?
Not so much, but I want to give us we're running out of the show, so I want to give us the one last dose of good news. Unless Deirdre has any last thoughts on GMO.
I would like to say that Lynch's team did help with GMO companies and their production of canola and their enhancement to the canola plant, which is huge in Canada. So they can work together. Like, it's not mutually exclusive.
Right. Awesome. So, to carry on the good news, because we're now down to 2 minutes left. The last piece of good news that we promised to tease, this is the one that actually is, I think, just good news, is that Washington, D.C.'s pension fund has announced full fossil fuel divestment. We need like a clapping sound to hit. Like, yay! Nice. Well done. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. In-house. We also do in-house soundboards for everyone.
Fully.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But what's for full divestment. And not only that, what's interesting about this is that they went ahead and did it for the last couple. They've been doing it for the last couple of years.
I thought that was hilarious. They're doing it in secret.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they were like, psych, we basically already done it. And they're mic dropping and walking away. Like, it's, you know, it's $6.4 billion. So it's not a unbelievably massive thing, but it's a yet another, you know, it seems that cities and districts are increasingly being proven to be the places where people where progressive policies on this sort of thing can push for it. So to see a large district, especially the one that houses the White House, you know, to actually take action on this is encouraging, at least.
All right. So we're going to leave it there. I have more stuff for the bonus show. You've been listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Thank you so much to our radio partners, our listeners, and as well as my two co-hosts today and our tech in the other room. We're going to continue the discussion a little bit about GMO and have some other fun. I have another non-environment thing, but I'm not going to tease it at all. You're just going to listen to the podcast. Download that at greenmajority.ca for our brief after show and the polished edit version of the program. But with that, we'll just leave it there. We're going to cruise out on a high note. Thank you very much to Stefan, Deirdre, and Alex for joining me today. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green Majority here at CIUT 89.5 FM.